just 3 pantries for its population of 129,000. The safety nets are not as robust. A strong safety net also requires pantries to cooperate with one another and a broader array of local social services. That's been happening for years in Flint, Michigan, said Denise Diller, executive director of Crossover Downtown Outreach Ministry, which runs a pantry in Flint, Michigan. Agencies and community leaders banded together in 2014 when lead poisoned the drinking water. When COVID occurred, we were already kind of ready, Denise Diller said. So was Atlanta. As in Flint, Michigan, hunger was never hidden there. 15% of children in Fulton County, which includes Atlanta, Georgia, faced hunger before the pandemic. After COVID suspended volunteer shifts, the Atlanta Community Food Bank asked the Georgia National Guard to help sort, pack, warehouse, and deliver food to help meet the needs of the estimated 22% of children experiencing hunger. The food bank also partnered with 7 school districts on more than 30 mobile pantries. Such coordination and connections were lacking in Bergen County, where 80 pantries worked mostly in isolation when the pandemic hit, County Commissioner Tracy Zuhl said. They weren't collaborating. They were going along the same path they had for decades, she said. That was this need to break out of the old way of doing things and work together to be more impactful. Tracy Zuhl spearheaded the creation of a food security task force in July, reaching out to municipal and faith leaders. Goals included feeding people, connecting them to other services, and turning some emergency food programs into fully fledged pantries. Building an infrastructure is painstaking work and ongoing work, she said. Now Tracy Zuhl says pantries are starting to share with one another. When one gets a large donation of perishable items such as eggs or milk.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians, from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
Cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came and conquered and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish, it's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events, and I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given, at the very least, cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It is refreshing to see.
Yeah, very much so.
And Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, oh, there's violence on both sides, I was shot at once, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun, and then he's asked later on, why do you live with your children in this dangerous area? He said, oh, it only happened to once. Mm. But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, when I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this.
It was was really interesting to see that Israeli author age over the course of this documentary. But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. So I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to, you know, communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It's filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized that it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000, so that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other, so it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have swimming, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. And to see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads, you can see the road. I don't talk about the lights, I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Chayadu Aglit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you for that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different with all its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident. That's it's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Bloc, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of you know, all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why, then, is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing, and therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society, which has to adopt boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. There are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are accepting, tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself is very bad for Israel.
Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films. You can see that this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran as when he first started shooting all this and than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the US government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world. And the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this will this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel Lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel Lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism is started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think it's the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this movie can make it, this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how the Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yes.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audience?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if we could we're coming to the end of the programme now. If I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it is worth seeking out for that reason.
And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story and we have failed and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
One day after a spring break, Oasis of South Beach descended into chaos, with the police struggling to control overwhelming crowds and making scores of arrests. Officials in Miami Beach decided on Sunday, 21st of March, to extend an emergency curfew for up to 3 weeks. The police fired pepper balls to disperse crowds after an 8 p.m. curfew went into effect on Saturday, 20th of March. Local Miami officials said people had flocked to the city of Miami because of its relatively few coronavirus restrictions. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Neil Vigdor and Azzy Pabara. The piece is titled Miami Beach, Overwhelmed by Spring Break, Extends Emergency Curfew. Stay with us for more of Neil Vigdor and Azzy Pabara's article. One day after the spring break, Oasis of South Beach descended into chaos, with the police struggling to control overwhelming crowds and making scores of arrests. Officials in Miami Beach decided on Sunday, 21st of March, to extend an emergency curfew for up to 3 weeks. The police fired pepper balls to disperse crowds after an 8 p.m. curfew went into effect on Saturday, 20th of March. Local Miami officials said people had flocked to the city of Miami because of its relatively few coronavirus restrictions. The officials there went so far as to approve closing the famed Ocean Drive to all vehicular and pedestrian traffic from 8 p.m. up to 6 a.m., the hours of the curfew, for the 4 nights a week through 12th of April. Residents, hotel guests, and employees of local businesses are exempt from the closure. The Strip, frequented by celebrities and tourists alike, was the scene of a much-criticized skirmish on Saturday night, 20th of March, between, at times, unruly spring breakers who ignored social distancing rules and wearing face mask guidelines, and police officers who used pepper balls to disperse a large crowd just hours after the curfew had been introduced. The restrictions were a stunning concession to the city's inability to control unwieldy crowds of revelers, and the city and the state of Florida aggressively quartered amid the continuing coronavirus pandemic. I believe it's a lot of pent-up demand from the pandemic and people wanting to get out, and our state has been publicly advertised as being open, so that's contributing to the issue, David Richardson, a member of the Miami Beach City Commission, said on Sunday. In an emergency meeting, the commission approved maintaining the 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew from Thursday, 25th of March, through to Sunday for 3 more weeks, which is when spring break typically ends. Officials also kept in place bridge closures on the nights of the curfew along several causeways that connect Miami Beach with the mainland. The city's decision to send police personnel in riot gear into the South Beach Entertainment District on Saturday, 20th of March, only a few hours after the curfew was announced, came under heavy fire, especially from local black leaders. They noted that many of the spring breakers who had been dispersed were young African Americans. It's the same group of kids that are in South Padre Island right now, except those kids happen to be white, said Stephen Hunter Johnson, chairman of Miami-Dade's Black Affairs Advisory Board, referring to the popular spring break destination in Texas. Mr. Johnson said the city did a poor job of rolling out the curfew and enforcing it. This entire economy thrives off vacation, he said. But when you have kids that feel as if they're being over-policed or policed differently in an environment post-George Floyd, where we don't shirk back from that, but we confront it head-on, this leads to situations where the police officers feel understandably like they're being put in an unfair situation. The 8 p.m. curfew on Saturday, 20th of March, in the city's South Beach Entertainment District was initially put in place for 72 hours. On Sunday, 21st of March, Miami City officials voted unanimously to extend the emergency declaration until Monday, with the city manager empowered to extend it again. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, a Republican, has touted his state's lack of pandemic restrictions compared with other parts of the country controlled by Democrats. If you look at South Florida right now, this place is booming, Mr. DeSantis said recently. Los Angeles isn't booming. New York City isn't booming. Miami-Dade County, which includes Miami Beach, has recently endured one of the nation's worst outbreaks, and more than 32,000 Floridians have died from the coronavirus. The state is also thought to have the highest concentration of B.1.1.7 variant, the more contagious and possibly more lethal virus variant first identified in Britain. Some blame the unusually large crowds on a spring break season supercharged by a pandemic that has limited socializing. Mr. Richardson, the Miami commissioner, said what Miami Beach was facing is far greater than spring break, and that's why we are experiencing the large number of crowds that we are. Ricky Ariola, another city commissioner, said at the meeting, "Shutting things down cannot be the way the city does business. It is embarrassing, and it just shows we don't know what we're doing." Ricky Ariola also said that as the city is grappling with one holiday, it needs to start planning for another. "We've got caught flat-footed this spring break, and we're going to walk right into the punch of Memorial Day weekend." Businesses about 30 miles north in the city of Fort Lauderdale are monitoring the developments in Miami Beach. "We've been watching it very closely," Dan Lindblade, the president and chief executive of the Greater Fort Lauderdale Chamber of Commerce, said on Sunday evening. "We'll do everything we have to do to make sure we don't have the same situation happen up here." Fort Lauderdale dealt with similar spring break problems in the 1980s and early 1990s, until the city and businesses decided to make some changes, he said. One major change: hotels started charging more money for rooms. The effect, Mr. Lindblade said, has been notable. "It's a family-oriented atmosphere, and that's been great for our economy," he said.
U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has already started a war of words with countries it deems adversaries, namely North Korea, China, and Russia. The rhetoric between Washington and Beijing escalated after U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's trip to South Korea and Japan, where he leveled allegations against China and North Korea, expressing concern about their activities. The first high-level in-person talks between top American and Chinese diplomats revealed the extent of the rift in their bilateral ties. The two-day meeting held in Alaska saw the two sides trading barbs over a host of issues during the opening session, which usually takes minutes to complete, but in this case lasted for well over an hour. The Biden administration has also taken a hard-line stance against the other U.S. rival, Russia, with the State Department threatening sanctions on any entity that would get involved in the development of the Nord Stream 2 project, a pipeline which would stretch from Russia to Germany. The U.S. has accused Russia of trying to influence the 2020 presidential election. In an interview, Biden said Russia will, quote, pay a price for attempting to meddle in the election, while suggesting that his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, was a killer.
The U.S. A big brother policy, if you want to call it that, is also targeting the Europeans, trying to stop the very important pipeline between Russia and Germany. And they're attacking the very interests of those people that they're trying to bring on board. All these countries have different relations with China and different relations with Russia. And we saw how the Europeans reacted, or didn't react, I would say, to Biden's, you know, outrageous claims that Putin was a killer. Nobody is backing him up, and I think they were very shocked by the words of the president, and they're not very happy with the results of that, and certainly doesn't represent their opinion.
Moscow, Beijing, and Pyongyang, on their part, have responded to the hostile remarks. Yet the fiery U.S. statements are reminiscent of foreign policy adopted by the hawkish administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Pyongyang was quick to respond to the U.S. threats. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's influential sister on Tuesday warned the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden against, quote, causing a stink at its first step if it wanted to sleep in peace for the next 4 years. Kim Yo-jong, who is a key advisor to her brother, denounced the annual joint U.S.-South Korea military drills, which began earlier this month, saying war drills and hostility can never go with dialogue and cooperation. But the U.S. later clarified its position on North Korea, with Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin saying Washington was ready to, quote, fight tonight. U.S. officials' incendiary remarks prompted a response from China as well. Beijing has noted that the U.S. has no longer the qualification to speak to China from a position of power. In the meantime, Russian President Vladimir Putin hit back at Biden, who had called him a killer, saying it takes one to know one. Also, Russia recalled its ambassador to the U.S. for consultations.
So the U.S. is playing a very dangerous game because they think that they're leading this big troop of international nations to meet the so-called autocracies, i.e. Russia and China, whereas I think if they look behind them, they're going to see that their army is quickly fading and disappearing and going their own way. But it's a dangerous situation because they're pursuing that. The United States is still, you know, probably militarily, undoubtedly, the most powerful country in the world. They could bring the world to war, and that's where the danger is. But I think most of the other countries are rational enough to understand that pursuing a path of trying to contain or delimit or even undermine the sovereign governments of Russia and China, or either one of those, is a very dangerous game that will only lead to military conflict, and I think they're not going to be on board that policy.
Many observers expected the Biden era to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies. Just over 2 months into his presidency, however, Biden has set the tone for what the world can expect for at least the next 4 years.
So September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown directly to the twin World Trade Center buildings in New York City. A few days later, U.S. Congress passed a resolution which has been used to justify Washington's military interventions abroad and detentions in Guantanamo Bay prison since. The authorization of the use of military force, or AUMF, granted the U.S. President the authority to use force against those who were involved in the 9/11 attacks. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called War on Terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. According to the Cost of War Project reports, since 2003, over 9.2 million Iraqis have been displaced across the country or have become refugees abroad. Washington is also responsible for around 300,000 deaths in Iraq between 2003 and 2009, a figure that could be much higher. Over two-thirds were civilians. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. That's while during the 2016 presidential campaigns, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. But Washington's acts did not end there. In 2020, four members of the U.S. private military firm Blackwater were pardoned. That is while Blackwater's mercenaries were prosecuted and found guilty of multiple criminal acts committed during a 2007 massacre at Nisr Square in Baghdad, which left 17 unarmed civilians dead and at least 20 wounded. The U.S.-led war in Iraq has had its negative impact on American people's lives as well. U.S. taxpayers have paid nearly $2 trillion in war-related costs on the Iraq war alone. That's an average of $8,000 per person and represents 9% of the national debt.
What the U.S. intended to do in Iraq is exactly what we see right now. The outcome that they were looking for is the destruction of the country, its continuous chaos in this country, in order for them to loot all the resources at the lowest cost.
A recent report published by the Cost of War Project says the U.S. military has conducted so-called counter-terror activities in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. The U.S. troops have also conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Moreover, Washington owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That is while China is the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. The ongoing war on terror has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and over 335,000 civilians have lost their lives.
The war on terrorism is a war for terrorism, when in reality, the terrorism being created by the United States, the intended target is the destruction of the Arab and Muslim people.
After spending over $6.4 trillion and ruining lives of millions during the War on Terror campaign, Washington has failed to win a single war as of yet. With that, why does Washington fail to learn its lesson? The U.S. should correct the course now by repealing the 2002 AUMF.
The United States and China have held their first high-level in-person talk since President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office in Alaska on Thursday. The growing rift between the two nations was made evident before the media as diplomats traded barbs during the opening session, a formal function in diplomatic talks that's supposed to take minutes, which in this case lasted for an hour. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken said the issue of Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on United States, blame on China, and what he called Beijing's economic coercion toward Washington's allies would be discussed during the two-day talks. In response, China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi slammed the U.S. for interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The official also lashed out at Washington for what he called its struggling democracy and poor treatment of minorities. He also sharply criticized the U.S. foreign and trade policy. Blinken accused China of grandstanding during the public meeting, while his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi slammed the U.S., quote, inhospitality.
I think that the Chinese representatives were not expecting a friendly meeting, but I think we're surprised by the how intensely aggressive and hostile the statements were coming from the U.S. side. The Biden administration's attitude toward China and orientation toward China is even more hostile and belligerent and aggressive than was Trump. Every day there's something new.
Experts also believe the first major meeting between the two superpowers suggests that a reset of ties is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. During the bitter talks, the United States accused China of human rights violations. The Chinese foreign minister was quick to respond. He noted that the U.S. no longer has the qualification to speak to China from a position of strength, adding that many Americans have little confidence in the U.S. democracy.
In the United States, police kill over 1,100 people on the average year, and that's over the last 6 years. That's three a day. There's no other advanced capitalist country, developed capitalist country, that comes even close. Canada is the next one. And the U.S. rate is four times Canada's, but it's 27 times the rate in Germany and 67 times the rate of police killing in England and Wales. So those are very serious violations of human rights. There's great poverty in large sections of the U.S. and no prospects for getting better. That's a violation of human rights. So this very condescending attitude that the U.S. representatives are taking, and their idea that they can lecture others about human rights in the world, is I think much refuted by people all over the world, the governments and people all over the world today.
As part of his go-it-alone policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump provoked an all-out trade war with China, imposing several rounds of tariffs against billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports, a move that Beijing retaliated. The Trump administration also sanctioned several Chinese officials and major companies over a variety of different allegations, ranging from human rights violations to threatening the U.S. national security. During the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign, Trump's fellow Republicans feared that Joe Biden would adopt a soft stance on China. However, top Republicans have in recent weeks voiced approval of Biden's attempts to reset relations with Washington's allies and uniting them against China. Although the Biden administration is yet to clearly define its China policy, the opening of the first major meeting between the two sides served as a preview of what lies ahead for the two nations for at least the next 4 years.
Legal filings submitted by the British law firm code speeches where the Syrian First Lady praises the mothers of Syrian soldiers killed on the front line. It also points to interviews where she supports her husband and soldiers for defending their homeland. The law firm says the evidence compiled, in our view, legally speaking, far exceeds what may be considered reasonable comment or mere propaganda and amount to the incitement, encouragement, and or aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Again, analysts question why there has been no investigation for a single politician whose country has committed war crimes, such as leaders and officials in the U.S. or the U.K. and France.
The West takes it upon itself that they can attack and invade countries at will, and everything they do is justified, even if it's based on fabricated evidence, like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and, of course, the attack on Syria. This is... the United States, even under Obama, which was much better, was illegally invading countries. There was no justification, no resolution from the UN Security Council. And, it was pure hypocrisy that Syria represented a threat to the United States, or this is a defensive war.
The timing of this move raises further question marks. On Monday, the UK had imposed new sanctions on six Syrian government officials, including the country's foreign minister.
Now that the fighting has subsided in Syria and government forces have the upper hand against terror groups, any military plots to overthrow the government appear to have failed. Could the West be looking at new ideas to destabilize the country? Syria faces fresh problems today, including the spread of the coronavirus and the state of its economy. American forces are occupying the country's east, where the oil reserves are, thereby preventing Damascus from using its oil revenue to rebuild vital infrastructure. The U.S. and Israel continue to launch airstrikes. Syria also accuses the European Union of being responsible for the suffering and bloodshed of civilians, saying the bloc, along with Britain, has backed terrorist groups. Yet, civilians are starting to return to many liberated parts of their homeland, including entire provinces that had been destroyed by various terror groups. Researchers say since March 2011, Washington has led a coalition of NATO countries, Arab monarchies, and Israel in a proxy regime change war using terrorist mercenaries as foot soldiers. Perhaps a wider investigation is needed to establish who supported the terrorists, who funded them, who backed them, who provided them with training, and who really committed war crimes in the Arab country. Britain's Metropolitan Police have opened a preliminary investigation into the wife of Syria's First Lady, Asma al-Assad. A London-based law firm has filed a complaint over allegations of incitement and encouragement to commit acts of terrorism. Asma has dual British-Syrian nationality and could reportedly lose her British citizenship and have an international arrest warrant issued if convicted. The Metropolitan Police say it received a referral in July last year relating to the ongoing Syrian conflict. In a statement, the Met says the referral is in the process of being assessed by officers from the War Crimes Unit. British media suggests police are considering whether there is enough evidence to carry out a full investigation. This is why analysts say there is sufficient evidence to investigate former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for his leading role in the invasion of Iraq.
A total double standard. Actually, Tony Blair admitted that that George Bush was fabricating evidence against Syria for the war. Of course, you know, Blair has been, you know, invading a country. There's no legitimate reason for that. Plus, American troops are there at the present time, and British troops are actually even in Syria and French troops for a very long period of time, which does constitute a war crime.
As a result of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed. The invasion also led to the birth of terrorist groups that had no presence in the country before. These terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Daesh, have killed and raped locals on a mass scale and ravaged the entire country. Yet the perpetrators of the invasion and its aftermath continue to live a lavish lifestyle. On the other hand, Asma al-Assad has suffered from cancer and has paid a considerable amount being treated for the disease, which raises questions over her role in the alleged crimes committed.
Hello.
Happy New Year.
Bye-bye. We congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the limelight.
By promoting fossil fuel projects overseas, especially gas infrastructure, the United States is making it harder for countries to decarbonize. Han Chen, manager of energy for the International Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, said in a statement. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson. The article is published under the heading, More than 430 groups from six continents demand Biden end all U.S. subsidies for global fossil fuel projects. stay with us for more of Jake Johnson's article. A coalition of more than 430 environmental organizations spanning 53 countries have recently called on the Biden administration to quickly cut off all U.S. public financing for fossil fuel projects overseas and work with governments around the world to bring about an end to taxpayer subsidies for the dirty energy sources driving the global climate emergency. We urge the Biden administration to act swiftly to end new financing for all parts of the fossil fuel supply chain, including for gas, stop new U.S. fossil fuel support within 90 days across all government institutions, and work with other nations to end fossil fuel financing, reads a letter sent to top Biden administration officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, and Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. Signed by 432 environmental groups from six continents, including Africa, Asia, and South America, comes weeks after U.S. President Joe Biden delivered a speech at the White House condemning handouts to big oil and vowing to work with U.S. Congress to eliminate subsidies to fossil fuel industry in the United States. Governments can't claim to be serious about climate change if they pump billions of dollars into the most polluting industries every year, said Alex Dukas of Oil Change International, one of the signatories. If President Joe Biden is serious about zeroing out emissions by mid-century or even earlier, the U.S. must end its billions of dollars in support for oil, gas, and coal projects around the world. Arguing the United States' action to end public funding of fossil fuel infrastructure could spur other nations to follow suit, the new letter urges President Biden to follow through on his initial steps towards launching a whole-of-government approach to tackling the climate crisis. The groups point to Biden's January executive order directing federal officials to craft a plan aimed at promoting the flow of capital towards climate-aligned investments and away from high-carbon investments. Despite the need to rapidly reduce fossil fuel production and use, G20 governments have provided more than three times as much in public finance for fossil fuel as for renewable energy every single year since the 2015 adoption of the Paris Climate Accord, the group noted. U.S. institutions such as the U.S. Export-Import Bank, EXIM, and the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, DFC, have provided billions of dollars for new fossil fuel projects annually, together averaging $4.4 billion per year over the past decade. The good news is that by acting decisively, the letter continues, the Biden administration can accelerate a global shift away from public finance for fossil fuels. The coalition proceeds to lay out its desired timeline for action.